You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And this week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Beckman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Castor. Good afternoon, Armani. Yeah.
And we've got lots of science on today, which I'm quite excited about, given the little sneak peeks I've had of these individual stories. Starting off with coffee, pertinent issue for many of our listeners and most people in the world, I'd imagine. Certainly a lot.
Well, not me.
Not you.
Not me, no.
Wow.
No,
not me either, actually. I'm saying it like it's a very shocking bit of information. I'm not a huge coffee drinker as well.
I live and die by my blood orange fruit tea. It's good. It's good.
But how can we use physics here to make better coffee?
Well, it's not necessarily making better coffee. It's making more efficient coffee.
More efficient coffee.
Because apparently the weather in the past 4 years has not been amenable to growing coffee. And so sort of yields are down. We've got the whole climate change going on and everything. And so because the yields are down, the price is going up, et cetera, et cetera. So people are looking for efficiencies. And obviously one of those would be how can we make more coffee with less.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And so a bunch of physicists at University of Pennsylvania thought that as well. And so they embarked on a study of how to improve the extraction efficiency of coffee grounds. Now, again, I'm not a coffee person, so I believe this of what we're going to talk about relates to filter coffee rather than your sort of, you know, espressos and everything done on the big machine when you're forcing, you know, high pressure steam and water and everything through, blah, 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 blah. So, and filter coffee is very popular in the States. I sort of remember that when I was there. So, this is a study of fluid mechanics.
Fluid mechanics.
Fluid mechanics. So you can't get more physicists than, or physical sort of stuff than fluid mechanics, which is all to do with the behavior of fluids.
That makes sense.
Water being your fluid. And how that fluid interacts then with with particles, and these particles are going to be your coffee grounds. Okay. And that's what happens when we make a cup of coffee like this. You're looking at the water extracting all of those yummy, flavorful bits from the grounds of the coffee, okay? And in order to do that, you've got to get the maximum possible interaction of those particles with the water. So that's what has to be studied.
Most points
studied
of contact,
here.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. So you want the maximum amount of contact with the maximum number of particles, basically.
Yeah.
Okay? So how do we do that? Well, they sort of thought, well, you know, we've got a fancy lab here. Let's see what we can see. And just sort of using coffee, they couldn't really see much because coffee's kind of dark. And so that sort of obscures views and stuff and everything. So instead of using coffee, what they used were sort of transparent silica particles.
So not for drinking.
No, not for drinking. But again, they are just looking at the behavior of those particles. Doesn't matter what they are necessarily.
Yeah. But better to look at.
How do those particles interact with the liquid? And are we getting that maximal contact with the liquid that we were talking about? So they, as I said, have got a or have a very well-equipped lab. And so they've got sort of lasers. They've got high-speed cameras and stuff like that. And so that's they put these to the test. And investigated or visualized essentially what happens when you take a stream of water being poured out of some vessel onto these particles of silica, what actually happens. And so what they found, the important thing that they found, the really important thing, was that you get all these sort of miniature avalanches occurring when the water hits these solid particles. Okay, and you get these sort of avalanches of particles, and these avalanches of particles help their extraction. They maximize the contact, or the maximum number of particles with the liquid. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that you want going on. You want these avalanches of particles. Okay, and now this might seem fairly obvious, but the higher you pour the water from, the more of these avalanches you're going to get. So that seems sort of reasonable. You're disturbing the particles. You're getting them moving. That's exactly what you want for, you know, for efficient extraction. Now. And so you might think the higher and higher and higher and higher, the better, but not necessarily.
There's a break point.
Not necessarily, because now we've I'm delving back to my second year applied chemistry here. We learned all about laminar flow and turbulent flow.
What are laminar flow and turbulent flow?
Okay, so remember, so when you turn on a tap really nice and slowly,
yeah,
you get this lovely, just a stream, a perfect stream of water. Okay,
yep.
It's not moving or anything like that. It's not wobbling. It's just this perfect stream of water. Whereas if you turn on a tap really fast,
it's
all over the place. Okay, so the former is called laminar flow. Okay, laminar flow, and the latter is called turbulent flow.
Turbulent, that makes sense.
And it's all to do with a thing called a Reynolds number, which I'm not going to go into here, which I once knew many, many years ago. But what they are looking for is turbulent flow. Turbulent flow is the most efficient at getting these little avalanches going.
Makes sense. Lots of movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want to pour it nice and gently so that you get this turbulent, so you get this laminar flow. If you go turbulent, if you pour it too fast, then instead of getting this lovely single stream of water, you get all sort of breaks and stuff in it. You get air bubbles in it and everything, and that limits the efficiency of the extraction. It stops those miniature avalanches. They're not so good, and it just doesn't work so well. Mm. So the guts of it is that you want a thick laminar flow to get the maximum and from a decent height.
Yeah.
Okay? You don't want to go too high, otherwise it doesn't work. It's just got to be about the right height. And you're looking at nice sort of laminar flow, okay?
Yeah.
And you want, you know, a thick stream of water is good, but a thin stream is also okay as well, because that'll still be laminar. But if it's a thin stream, then that increases the time that it is actually interacting with those particles, and so therefore you should be getting more extraction doing it that way. So. This is basically the physicist's way of making more efficient coffee, getting more extraction out of less, essentially. So, you know, who knows? We may be forced to
practice
do all
these
this.
At home. Very interesting. And then next year, Inuit words for snow. There's lots of them, famously, right? There's a bit of a saying about it.
Mm.
What are we learning about these words?
Well, that's the thing, because this, you know, you say that, oh, you know, the Inuits have lots of word for snow, and that's what these people in Australia and the USA thought as well. You know, they'd often heard this, that, oh, yeah, the Inuit have lots of word for snow. But do they?
Do
really?
They?
You know,
what's the real?
And so this is one of these things that are, as my old PhD boss used to say, often assumed but seldom demonstrated, which I think is a lovely phrase. And so, as I say, so these workers from Australia and the USA decided to actually test this out.
Yeah.
And not only just the fact that, you know, supposedly the Inuit have lots of words for snow, but what they're interested in is, you know, if this is the case, why do the Inuit have lots of words for snow?
Yeah, that different seems, kinds of
that
snow.
That seems pretty obvious because, you know, it's all around them.
Yeah.
And so they were thinking, well, obviously environment could very well be important when it comes to language. That, you know, so for example, yes, the Inuit languages do have lots of words for, in fact, not snow, but sea ice. Different types of sea ice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Native Australian languages, okay, they have lots of words for, surprise, surprise, sand, or related to sand.
Yeah.
Okay. And that seems to make sense, some sort of intuitive sense that, your environment, you know, if you're trying to distinguish between very, very similar things that are part of your environment, of course you're going to have lots of different words for those, you know, seemingly very similar things. And that seems reasonable. But, for example, Hindi, apparently, has got lots of words for love. Okay. Lots of words for love and related to love. Okay. So, and a Native American language, Yana, has got many words related to both eyes and eyesight. Okay. So now the reason for that is not, the reason for both of those is not necessarily obvious. Why should the Hindi have, why should Hindi have lots of words for love and this Native American language, lots of words related to eyes and sight? So, what these researchers then did was they thought, okay, well, let's check this out. And so they made a deep dive into 616, count them, different languages.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And are we dealing, I mean, these 616, I assume, is not the number of total languages regularly spoken.
No. So but these are 616 dictionaries that were available for different languages.
Yeah, wow.
Okay? And so they're sort of making a deep dive through this sort of stuff. And, you know, there's no real sort of major assumptions that you can make about the results or anything like that, but just some of the individual results themselves are very, very intriguing. Okay. Yeah. So, for example, which language do you think would have the most words for or related to horse?
Horse. Hmm. Well, I mean, these are pretty obvious answer. Am I going to get it right
if I
say the obvious? Well, I feel like it's got to be a culture that has strong relation to horses, surely.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. And the first one that comes to mind are the Mongols.
Oh, sheesh. There's no fooling you, is there?
Wow, I got it right. Well, I was feeling very hesitant
very good.
In case I got it wrong.
Very good. Yeah. Well, there are, in fact, four. The major four languages. You got one of them, so Mongolian, Kazakh, which doesn't surprise, and a little bit more surprisingly, probably French and German.
French and German. Lots of horse-related activities.
Obviously, yeah. I guess, So that's kind of interesting. Which language do you think might have a lot of words for duty and obligation? Duty and obligation, or related to that. There you go.
That's a bit tricky.
This has turned into a quiz.
I've got no clue for that one.
Japanese.
That makes sense.
Which, again, does make sense. You know, as soon as you hear it, And not surprisingly, the top four, snow. Okay, we had three Inuit languages, and they had the most words for snow. And this is where I stick in my Kate Bush reference, because we should always reference Kate Bush, because she's just amazing.
Yeah.
She put out an album called 50 Words for Snow.
50 Words for Snow.
Which everyone should go and listen to, because it's utterly wonderful. So these Inuit languages, okay, so they're not just words for snow, but we've got words for, a single word, for example, noisy walking on hard snow.
Mm.
Okay, they've got that, a word for that. And the first snowfall, okay, so they've got a word for that. So these are words all related to their environment, okay? Now, so you might think, okay, the people that live in places where there are lots of snow are going to have lots of words related to that. So you might think, well, people who live in rainy parts should have the most words for
rain
and stuff like that. Not necessarily.
No.
Not necessarily.
Not at all.
So there
So
there are some languages in South Africa, and they have lots of rain-related words, okay? Which is kind of interesting, because South Africa is not exactly a place that gets truckloads of rain.
Yeah.
Okay, go up to Central Africa and you'll have, lots and lots of rain up there. But they don't exactly get lots and lots of rain. But then the explanation for this is, well, obviously... rain is, the fact they have lots of words for it attests to its importance for life.
Yeah, it's very important. That's okay. I was imagining maybe a region with more drought would have a lot
exactly.
of words.
Exactly. And
for
so
rain.
Now, so you're talking about somewhere that has an absence of rain, and now that becomes important as well. Mm. Conversely, I guess, their environment and stuff like that. Now, the oceanic languages, again, interesting stuff. They seem to have lots of words related to smell. Okay. And again, so, for example, Marshallese from the Marshall Islands. So Marshallese has words for individuals. Smell of damp clothing.
That's a useful one. I wish we had that word. Yeah.
Smell of blood.
Mm.
Smell of fish lingering on hands, body, or utensils.
Mm. Another handy one, I suspect, for lots of people out there.
So, these are just a few of, the very interesting results that they have reported. So this has just been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, which is an extremely good journal. So if you're interested, I would say go along and have a quick read of that. It'd be fairly readable. I mean, the one language that sort of strikes me is Germans seem to have a word for everything. My favorite German word is Schadenfreude, joy in other people's misfortune. I mean, what a great word.
It's a perfect word for the thing it describes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So there you go. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Language.
And then next year we've got Leonardo da Vinci's birthday. I wanted to sidetrack briefly for a quick question to you this time.
Oh, jeez.
A Leonardo-related question. Who's your favourite turtle out of the four Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
I'm too old for that.
You're too old
I'm
for
too
any
old
of the turtles?
That. Yeah.
Well, we'll assume...
I know they ate pizza or something, didn't they? That's all
they
I know.
Ate pizza. They sure did. Yeah. We'll assume in this case it's Leonardo da Vinci. I don't think they include the da Vinci part, but it's his birthday today.
It is indeed, and he would have been 573 years old today.
Pretty old.
Well, Methuselah made it to 900, so, it can be done. And why are we talking about Leonardo da Vinci on a science program, I guess, is the question.
Yeah.
And, for those of you who don't necessarily know, Leonardo da Vinci was what we call a polymath.
A polymath.
A polymath.
Yeah.
And sadly, we don't have polymaths these days. We seem to have polymaths back in the day. And a polymath is basically somebody who knows everything about everything, basically. Oh. Well, pretty much.
Yeah, that's perfect. Just and an expert in everything.
Back in the day when we knew less about everything,
it was possible to know.
Yes, see, exactly.
Right. That makes
exactly.
sense.
So, Leonardo, okay, so he painted the Mona Lisa in The Last Supper, you know, extraordinary pieces of work. Yeah. I've seen the Mona Lisa from a distance, like everybody else in Paris that day. But he was not only an amazing painter. He actually studied anatomy and physiology in his early years, and he put his art ability to the test in all of these, and he made very, very detailed, extraordinarily detailed sketches of, you know, your muscles and skeletons, tendons, all of that sort of stuff. And it even got to the point where he was given permission to dissect human corpses.
Wow.
And so there's a famous sketch of his of a fetus in the womb as a result of that. And just the detail in them is amazing, as you would expect from him, you know, given he was a great artist. And so not only anatomy and physiology, he was also pretty not too bad in engineering.
Yeah.
And he actually made sketches for flying machines.
Yeah, I've heard of the flying machines.
Yes, yeah.
Obviously they weren't that good. Right?
Well, again, it was impossible to make them at that time,
right,
sort of thing. And a particularly interesting one, he sort of had the screw sort of helical thing that sort of you'd think of the progenitor of the helicopter sort of thing. You know, we're talking the 1500 and whatever, you know, way back in the day.
And he knew.
And he at least
theorized.
Had a fair idea.
Yeah.
And so flying machines, yep. He designed barricades for a city to keep all the, you know, nasty people out who were trying to invade the city. He was involved in diverting or making plans to divert the flow of the Arno River, the one that flows through Florence.
Mm.
Okay, so that's, you know, hardcore engineering that. He was one of the first people to realise the importance of friction and the laws of friction.
Wow.
And he'd studied perpetual motion, and he figured out that perpetual motion is a myth and it can't happen. You know, so one of the first to do that. And basically, you know, the things that he couldn't do, you could, you know.
Couldn't really list them at the time,
Exactly. So, yeah, just an extraordinary human being, utterly, utterly amazing. And, you know, if he were only known for his art, which I think probably he is in many parts of the world, you know, that's an amazing thing to be known for. But you tack on this that he was expert in many other things, and particularly in science, it just boggles the mind
that one person
could know that much or do that much or whatever. And, you know, just
very impressive stuff.
I feel like, you know, walking away in shame, basically, you know.
So
happy birthday, Leonardo da Vinci.
Happy birthday. Yeah. And maybe he's got a lot to have said, to have done. Mm. He's still got his stuff all around, and maybe more contributions than we realise in the other fields as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what a legacy. We're talking about him 573 years after he was born. So, yeah, they won't be talking about me.
Well, here's hoping, right, they'll be talking about us in 573 years' time. Perhaps with such love and such admiration for our work. Here's hoping, and also to all of you. Thank you, Alan, for coming in this week. Thank you, Mosette, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.